Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, February 7th, 2018. South Sudan's Human Rights Commission says the National Security Service continues to commit atrocities across the country.
All the complaints that have come, no rape was carried out by one person. It's always two people, three people, four people, it's a group. And they are willing to protect whoever did that.
And armed groups in the former Western Equatorial State release hundreds of child soldiers.
I don't expect any violation to these standing orders. In order to get support from the UN, we signed the action and extended it. The aim is to declare SPLA as a child-free army.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A new report by the South Sudan Human Rights Commission says rape and arbitrary arrests are rampant across the country. The report notes that a majority of victims of human rights abuses have no access to justice. For VOA News, Dimo Silva Aurelio reports from Juba.
The 53-page report released today details human rights violations and atrocities committed by armed groups and security agents over the past 2 years. The report says targeted killings, arbitrary arrests and detentions, recruitment of child soldiers and rape continues unabated. Nyol Justin Yach, chairperson of the South Sudan Human Rights Commission, says in most cases it is not just rape but gang rape that is committed.
All the complaints that have come, no rape was carried out by one person. It's always two people, three people, four people, it's a group. And they are willing to protect whoever did that.
The report indicates an ethnic undertone in the most recent wave of violence that broke out in 2016. It says both government forces and SPLA-IO rebels, led by former FAS Vice President Riek Machar, were guilty of targeting civilians in parts of Equatoria and along highways during the second phase of the conflict. Yach says his commission has documented more than 200 cases of women and girls being raped by soldiers or men in uniform between 2016 and 2017. He says most of the victims are now living in the UN Protection of Civilian site in Juba, but not one case of rape has been prosecuted conclusively in a court of law. The commission recommends the establishment of a special court to try rape perpetrators. Nyol says his commission also found that national security and military intelligence operatives have arbitrarily arrested and detained people.
I think most of those were carried out by national security and military intelligence. And it's because they have a very nebulous kind of law that allows them to operate in that kind of fashion. There has to be an audit of the laws themselves, because some of the provisions in the bill, the National Security Bill, actually contravene the Bill of Rights.
Yach says the commission is recommending that only police have the power to arrest or detain civilians.
I think this idea of mortgaging every situation of the police to the national security has to stop. Okay? If you look in Juba now, security monitoring and everything is being done by national security. Then you ask, what is the work of the police? So I think there's a need for us to address this issue of who then stays in the city and who, what is the jurisdiction of each force.
Yach says the commission has been given no funds to effectively monitor human rights conditions across the country, noting that some of the commission's offices were closed after the conflict began in 2016. Christian Mikala, head of the Human Rights Division at the United Nations Mission in South Sudan, is urging that the South Sudan Human Rights Commission do more to document and report on human rights violations across the country.
UNMISS Human Rights Division particularly, and UNMISS in general, looks forward to the South Sudan Human Rights Commission being accredited to the Global Association of National Human Rights Institutions. But for that to happen, the commission must demonstrate, yes, as I was saying, independence, must report regularly and publicly, and must receive individual complaints from members of the public, and also must advocate for victims of human rights violations and abuses, and also must advocate for appropriate and adequate remedies.
Members of civil society groups who attended today's release of the report in Juba say the Human Rights Commission must do more than just delivering reports on war crimes and human rights abuses in South Sudan, saying it must take practical measures to protect civilians and ensure that perpetrators are brought to justice. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
More than 300 children, including 87 girls, were released by armed groups in Yambio today. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, says the release marks the start of demobilizing 700 children in the coming weeks. Gift Friday has more for VOA from Juba.
215 children aged between 10 and 16 years were released by the South Sudan National Liberation Movement. 96 children were released by the SPLM-IO. 13-year-old Moses Kumbo says he voluntarily joined other children who were aiding the rebels because he was facing many challenges and saw no other options.
So in the bush, we were there under the command of Brigadier General John Ume. So actually we were the security personnel. He could send us to go and stand on at the roadside and to know if the government sends the soldiers to come and attack us in the bush, and we send the information back to our commanders, and we could also loot some properties from the people who are passing, and we could also kidnap some and take them back.
Moses says he dropped out of school in primary 5, but now is ready to return to school. 14-year-old D. John says he was abducted and was forcefully recruited by rebels while on his way to his parents' farm in Gangura Payam in 2015 when fighting intensified in his area.
We're just cooking food and give to the soldiers.
John says he's happy to rejoin his family and hopes they will welcome him back into the community. The children were released at a ceremony attended by government and military officials along with aid workers in the Budu state capital, Yambio. During the ceremony, the children were formally disarmed and provided with civilian clothes. UNICEF says it will conduct medical screenings and provide the children with counseling and psychosocial support to enable them to reintegrate into their communities. Aid agencies will also provide 3 months' worth of food assistance to the children's families to support their initial reintegration. They will also receive vocational training aimed at improving household income and food security. UNICEF says the children with relatives in their area will be reunited with their families, while others will be placed in interim care centers until their families can be traced. South Sudan Defense Minister Kwol Manyang says his ministry has issued standing orders to field commanders not to recruit children into the army.
Children should not even stay in the barracks. They should not be made to wear military uniform. I don't expect any violation to these standing orders. In order to get support from the UN, we signed the action and extended it. The aim is to declare SPLA as a child-free army.
Minister Manyang says the SPLA has formed child protection units to ensure that no child is recruited into the army.
The work of this body is to have its representatives in all the army structures, that is, in the division, in the sector, in the division, in the brigade, and in the battalion. Their work is to see to it that no children are by mistake recruited in the army.
Despite today's release of hundreds of child soldiers, UNICEF says some 19,000 children continue to serve in the ranks of the armed forces and other militia groups more than 4 years after the conflict first erupted in December 2013. The agency says it needs another $45 million this year to support the release, demobilization, and reintegration of child soldiers across South Sudan. Gift Friday, VOA News, Juba.
Mercy Corps says hunger season in South Sudan is expected to begin 3 months earlier than usual, as families in the country are already running out of food supplies, threatening starvation and even death. Francisco Lalino, Mercy Corps acting director for South Sudan, says food insecurity among vulnerable populations continue to be a big problem in the country.
So as per the latest report, 4.8 million in South Sudan are severely food insecure. And the number of people in the IPC 4 phase, that is just the phase before famine, has doubled in compare of last year. And then we have more than 1 million children that face acute malnutrition. So our concern is also related to the lean season. So as you know now, all our beneficiaries and people we are supporting, they are running out of the food supplies they managed to harvest. And then we are really worried that before the next harvest will come, these people will have no access to food. Our concern is also related to access in some areas. So most of the most affected areas in South Sudan, affected or by acute malnutrition or food insecurity, there's still some local conflicts going on. And for us at Mercy Corps and other NGOs are very hard to reach.
You just said that the number of people categorized in level four has doubled. Why has this happened?
There are many reasons. I mean, one of the reasons is like this current conflicts and movement of people in the country, a lot of displacement, people that they need to move from an area to a different one, they don't have enough time to farm properly. So the time that you plant your crops and the time you harvest, maybe the instability and the insecurity, farmers cannot really move and be stable in one location to harvest. On the other hand, it's like more and more people are facing this current economic crisis in South Sudan, so they don't have enough resources to purchase seeds and farm properly. On the other hand, some areas, due to the current conflicts, are not cannot be are very hard to reach and to support. Because international NGOs and humanitarian actors cannot move safely in that area. So people, they haven't received enough food or seeds to farm properly. And then on the other side, there is the current inflation of the SSP. So this is actually affecting the purchase power of people. So they don't have enough money to purchase food or to purchase whatever they need to farm.
What's the risk level of going to that level four famine category?
The risk, if the insecurity situation and the conflicts will be still ongoing in South Sudan, the risk is very high. So one of the most affected areas in South Sudan, especially in the last year, was all the equatorial states. The equatorial states are considered like the green belt. All these areas, actually, in which these people will not have access to any food that they planted of the harvest or any food that can be delivered by the international NGOs, that really have high risk to fall again under famine. What is more interesting to see, the areas at risk of famine are the ones most affected by the current conflict.
That was Francisco Lanino, Mercy Corps Acting Director for South Sudan, speaking to Ian Bior from Juba this past hour. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a fresh wave of ethnic violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo. That story is coming up after this break.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
can you give up your cell phone for a day? Why or why not?
Well, I can't give up my cell phone because I have crucial information. I am exposed to the world. I need to know what is happening on a daily basis.
I can give out my cell phone if for a day, but I can't give it out forever, you know. It's just for a moment, huh? It doesn't matter.
No, I can't, because I do receive call on phone on it. Somebody can call me, Then I receive a call. If I leave without it, my friend cannot get me. That is the reason why I cannot leave without it.
I can, but no, it's not that easy. No, I can't. I have to communicate to my loved ones.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Scholars across Europe are poring over tens of thousands of Southern Sudan objects from the 18th and 19th century to help paint a picture of what life was like in Southern Sudan during this era. SINBO reports, academics hope the objects could also answer questions about South Sudan's history.
There was a leper hospital that opened in 1931 in Lerengu near Yambio, and at this hospital was a potter by the name of Mbetem. Beyond his name and title of head potter, not much else is known about him.
But he was making very, very beautiful figurative pottery to sell to kind of doctors or administrators or people that were passing through. So he made pots, but he also made sort of bookends with figures of people on them and really extraordinary bowls with these beautiful heads, which have, you see very clearly, sort of local hairstyles and scarification.
Zoe Cormack is a co-investigator of the South Sudan Museum Network. Cormack says Mbetem's story, as well as his artwork, which are in three European museums, help tell a much broader picture of southern Sudan. Mbetem's work was collected in 1933 by a British traveler and collector named Maj Pal Cotton and his wife Hannah, who visited Mbetem's workshop and bought many of his pieces, which made their way into the Pal Cotton Museum, the Pitt Rivers Museum, and the British Museum. The goal, according to Cormack, is to help understand what life was like in southern Sudan for people like Mbetem. But the artwork could also shed light on other aspects of the southern Sudanese experience, according to Cormack.
These objects also speak to maybe some much more urgent questions about identity, heritage preservation, and kind of recognizing the creativity and resilience that, you know, that also runs through South Sudanese history. So South Sudanese history is often told as one of conflict and struggle. And of course, that is a major theme. But at the same time, you know, violence does not define every aspect of people's lives. And sort of the creative arts provide an opportunity to explore these other aspects.
The Franz Binder Museum in the town of Sibiu, Romania, is almost entirely filled with objects from South Sudan. It displays the collection of Franz Binder, originally from Sibiu, who was a trader and consultant who was based in Khartoum between 1852 and 1863. Using these pieces to look back at history could help people avoid past mistakes, says El Fati Malouk Atimbeng, a Juba-based member of South Sudan Museum Network.
Although most of those like objects sometimes become like very painful memories, but it's important for us as South Sudanese to take a look at it and also to bring those memories. And I think that something can bring us together.
Cormack, an early career fellow at the African Studies Center at Oxford University, says the museum in Sibiu is not the only museum in Eastern Europe with a noticeable collection from South Sudan.
In Slovenia, in the Ethnographic Museum in Ljubljana, there is a significant collection of objects, mainly from kind of the area around Juba, because there was a Slovenian missionary who tried to establish a mission station there. And I think people really don't expect to see all of those different connections. And I think it sort of puts South Sudan in a kind of a different light, as, you know, a place that's often thought of as having been quite isolated, but actually has these really, really diverse international connections.
By connecting with objects in the past, Cormack thinks academics could help South Sudanese better understand who they are as a people.
So one of the questions we've been thinking about is, you know, how people in South Sudan or of South Sudanese descent could sort of connect or to reconnect with this aspect of cultural heritage and kind of think about what potential there might be for, exploring kind of identity or a kind of shared historical experience, especially in the context of the now interrupted process of nation building in South Sudan.
The South Sudan Museum Network is working on a comprehensive research project that is scheduled to be published in 2019. Ayan Bior for VOA News, Washington.
The UN Refugee Agency says the recent outbreak of ethnic violence in the Uthiri province in northern Democratic Republic of Congo could result into a mass exodus of refugees and internally displaced persons. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says violent clashes between the Hema and Lendu ethnic groups in Ituri province have killed at least 30 people and caused more than 5,000 to flee their homes. UNHCR spokesman Babar Baloch tells VOA the conflict, which erupted 5 days ago, is not new to this region. He says growing tensions over land and grazing rights between the two groups has led to this latest flare-up.
This is return of violence almost after 2 decades, when in late 1990s around 400,000 people were displaced because of the tensions between of the two groups.
Tens of thousands of people were killed between 1999 and 2003. Since then, a low-level conflict has existed in Ituri, broken by occasional flare-ups. UNHCR monitors in the region say many villages in Ituri's Jugu territory have been burned to the ground. Baloch says thousands of people have become internally displaced, and he says nearly 1,400 refugees fled to Uganda in search of refuge earlier this week.
Now, UNHCR offices on both sides of the border are once more on high alert. We fear the fighting could spread to the neighboring areas, particularly because of the circulation of light weapons in the region.
Baller says a majority of the refugees and internally displaced are women and children. He says access to some of the communities is limited. He says this is very worrying, as aid workers are unable to provide assistance to the displaced, who are in urgent need of food and other essential relief. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Modern life is filled with televisions, mobile phones, and other electronics. Technology advances so quick that many of these items are obsolete just a few years after production, so they get replaced and the old ones discarded. VOA's senior analyst Jeff Young reports parts of sub-Saharan Africa are being used as a dumping ground.
Their conveniences, their necessities, their status symbols, electronic goods such as TVs and phones. In with the new, out with the old. From the trash bins of Europe, North America, and other places, this ever-growing mountain of old electronics often winds up packed in containers shipped and dumped somewhere else, despite international bans on such disposal. The massive scope of the so-called e-waste problem is stated via Skype from Norway by Rehypto Norwegian Center analyst Christian Nelleman.
The global illegal trafficking in waste, electronic waste, is at least in the scale of 50 million tons annually. And considerable portions of this is dumped in West Africa.
While electronic waste dumping takes place across Africa, two nations, Nigeria and Ghana, are standouts. The United Nations Environment Program says Nigeria generates some 1.1 million tons of e-waste and Ghana about 180,000 tons per year. To get past bans, including the Basel and Bamako conventions, the presence of e-waste in shipments is often concealed, as discussed via Skype from Abidjan by the UNEP's Abdurrahman Bari.
People deliberately send e-waste using this mixed labeling. Labeling it has some equipment, electric equipment, but still can be used, but it's not true.
At the Agbabolshi dump in Accra and its similar sub-Saharan African e-waste graveyards, workers dismantle everything from computers and televisions to refrigerators, largely by smashing and burning things to extract metal from wires and circuit boards. Much of this work is done by young people, even children, and it's quite dangerous, according to the UNEP's Bari.
In doing so, they generate toxic chemicals like furans, dioxins, and they are directly exposed because they don't use any protective equipment.
These e-waste poisons not only saturate dump sites in the air above them, but when it rains, hazardous chemicals are washed both into the soil and eventually into nearby waters where they can enter the food chain and remain for years. Ghana has announced that it wants to establish recycling centers where things such as old electronics can be more cleanly and safely handled. Along with health incentives, these facilities have the technology to recover more of what is valuable, such as the gold plating on connectors and silver solder. Electronics manufacturing needs to be a closed cycle, according to an official at NGO Greenpeace, Elizabeth Jardine.
And it's also important for the companies that make these products to take responsibility for them at end of life and educate consumers about returning these products, incentivizing them to return the products so that they can handle them.
Ms. Jardine says Apple is one corporation that is moving in that direction. But until this closed cycle becomes the norm, sub-Saharan Africa will continue to drown in e-waste. Jeffrey Young, VOA News.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, John. A new report released by South Sudan's Human Rights Commission says women and girls continue to be raped by national security operatives, and security agents continue to arbitrarily arrest and detain people across the country. The 53-page report also says most victims of human rights abuses have no access to justice. The report details human rights violations and atrocities that have been reportedly committed over the past 2 years. Critics say the commission needs to do more than just issue reports, saying it should be monitoring violations and make sure that perpetrators are arrested. Neil Justine Yock, chairperson of the South Sudan Human Rights Commission, says in most cases it is not just rape, but gang rape. The report indicates that there is an ethnic undertone in most of the recent wave of violence that has broken out since 2016. More than 300 children were set free by armed groups in Yambio today. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, says the release marks the start of a process in which at least 700 children are expected to be freed over the coming weeks. 215 children between ages 10 and 16 were freed by the South Sudan National Liberation Movement, while 96 others were released by the SPLM-IO. And finally, the global organization Mercy Corps says hunger season in South Sudan is expected to begin 3 months earlier than usual, as households are already running out of food supplies, threatening starvation. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Banda by Dis Majos. We have been listening to Dis Majos with the song Banda. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Would like to know what you think about this show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also find us on Facebook. Our Facebook name is South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Banda, mojo re ibu bulong nori kojo. Ama, kule ngu kota lokon, ibu bulong nara aso. Dokro, dokro.